Welcome to 30 Minutes of VOA Learning English, the voice of America's information service for people learning English. Join us now for our daily magazine show, As It Is, and other programs designed for English learners.
Hello and welcome back. I'm Jim Tedder in Washington. We are here to help you learn and improve your American English skills. Today we have two very interesting and important stories for you. The first is about problems among young people in Asia. The second story is about space and what it might be like to live somewhere out there with Earth no longer your home. It's nice to have you with us. Let's get started with part one. A student election in Hong Kong is showing the increasing tensions between students from China's mainland and those from Hong Kong. The election took place last month at the University of Hong Kong. It followed the pro-democracy demonstrations last year in the former British territory. Jill Robbins joins us with more information.
Growing numbers of mainland Chinese students are crowding Hong Kong's classrooms and universities. As their numbers increase, tensions with students raised in Hong Kong appear to be rising. The University of Hong Kong has more mainland students than any other school in the city. Mainlanders represent about 16% of the university's total student population. The student union election there last month showed a sharp division between the two groups of students. Some students accused one candidate of being a spy for China's Communist Party. Nora Lam is a student and a reporter for the university's television station. She says one pro-China supporter was especially unhappy with her reporting on the student election. She accused the supporter of placing the private contact information and identification numbers of her friends on Facebook as an attempt to pressure her. In the days before the election, signs were hung from buildings on the University of Hong Kong grounds. One read, "To brainwashed, commie-loving mainlanders, we despite you." Other signs showed images of a student candidate next to former Chinese leader Mao Zedong. The candidate has earlier reported that his grandfather was a member of the Communist Party. One Chinese government-operated newspaper accused the Hong Kong students of McCarthyism. Joseph McCarthy was an American politician who targeted suspected communists in the United States during the 1950s. The People's Daily newspaper protested that mainland Chinese students were being treated unfairly as collateral targets. More recently, a Chinese official announced that Hong Kong must protect the security and dignity or self-respect of visitors from the mainland. Joseph Chung is a professor at the City University of Hong Kong. He says tensions between mainland and Hong Kong youth have been rising for many years. He says this has led to competitiveness, both in the classroom and student elections.
There's another level of tension with regard to election of the student union. Local students tend to be very suspicious of mainland Chinese students running for the election of the student union presidency and the cabinet and so on.
He says the pro-democracy protests show the increasing division in Hong Kong schools and in society. Last month, students voted to split from the Hong Kong Federation of Students, the city's most influential student organization. The main reason, disagreements about the way the Occupy Central demonstrations were directed last year. Pro-democracy activists have said they plan acts of civil disobedience in the weeks to come. I'm Jill Robbins.
You are listening to VOA, the voice of America, and we are coming to you from Washington. For generations, people have dreamed of traveling to Mars to explore Earth's closest planetary neighbor. NASA and other space agencies have announced plans to send people to the Red Planet, but such a manned mission is years away. In the United States, some volunteers are learning how people will react to months of separation from other humans on a Mars base. Ann Ball tells us about an experiment taking place in Hawaii.
What would it be like to live on the planet Mars? Volunteers are spending 8 months in an area that looks much like the surface of Mars, but actually they are living in Hawaii. Six people are isolated high on top of Mauna Loa, a volcanic mountain on the Big Island of Hawaii. They are living on a simulated or make-believe Mars base. The American space agency, NASA, has provided financial support for the work. The project is called High Seas, or Hawaii Space Exploration Analog and Simulation. Kim Binstead of the University of Hawaii is supervising the project. She walks across red lava rock from the volcano, 2,500 meters above sea level. Because it is so high, the land is not warm or rich with plants like the rest of Hawaii. Ms. Binstead says this stark environment is as close to Mars as you can find here on Earth.
Visually, it's very similar to what you see on Mars. You'll see that there's really no visible plant life, there's no visible animal life, and you've got this wonderful volcanic material. We're on a cinder cone here on Mauna Loa, and Mauna Loa is geologically very similar to Olympus Mons on Mars.
The six-member High Seas crew is mostly self-sufficient. They take care of themselves. Food and supplies are brought to them. But the individuals bringing those supplies cannot communicate with volunteers inside the habitat or base. Kim Binstead says this experiment looks at how the astronauts interact or get along with each other.
We study how well they work together, how we can keep them happy and supported and not wanting to kill each other over these long durations.
The current crew has been living in the habitat since October and will stay until June. Two earlier crews lived there before them. Crew members communicate with the outside world through email and blogs. They also produce videos on the YouTube website, like this one from Mission Commander Martha Linio.
Hi, Mission Support. This is Commander Martha from the High Seas Crew 3. I need some
crew members also are using a smartphone app or program that creates a 20-minute delay for communications. That would be the same as if you were communicating from Mars. This is not the only group of volunteers with sights set on Mars. A group called Mars One has appealed for would-be Mars astronauts from around the world. Mars One is a private, non-government project based in the Netherlands. Others believe the American or European space agencies are the most likely to put people on Mars, maybe in the 2030s or later. Whoever gets there first, the trip will not be easy, says Kim Binstead.
It's going to be challenging.
For now, on a mountaintop in Hawaii, volunteers are getting a taste of life on a future Mars base. I'm Ann Ball.
And I'm Jim Tedder in Washington. You are listening to VOA, the Voice of America.
Coming up, more programs designed for English learners. You can read and listen to our reports and download MP3s at learningenglish.voanews.com. You can learn with us on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at VOA Learning English.
On March 5th, Jasmine Hughes wrote in a New York Times blog, "Recently, at an IRL party, that is, a party that takes place in real life, as opposed to where I generally live, which is on the internet, a guest asked a friend and I how we met. The sentence includes a common error I have been seeing and hearing more and more often lately. The error is using the subject pronoun I when the object pronoun me should be used. Even President Obama can be heard using I for the object of a sentence. At his first press conference on November 7, 2008, he spoke about being invited to tour the White House. Well, President Bush graciously invited Michelle and I to meet with him and First Lady Laura Bush. English has 8 subject pronouns. I, you, he, she, it, we, you, and they. Subject pronouns show the actor in a sentence. For example, in the sentence, I speak English, I is the actor. English also has 8 object pronouns. Me, you, him, her, it, us, you, and them. We use an object pronoun to show the receiver of the action in a sentence, as in, she gave the book to me. In that sentence, me is the receiver. I think the confusion about I and me comes from instruction we get as children to be polite. When we mention ourselves and another person in a sentence, we are told to put the other person first. For example, we might be reminded to say, my brother and I went to the White House. Saying, I and my brother went to the White House is grammatically correct, but would sound impolite or rude. So, English speakers who are faced with 2 people in the object position in a sentence often grab for the phrase, somebody and I. They do not notice the phrase is grammatically incorrect. It just sounds more polite. Back to Miss Hughes, her party, and the New York Times blog. Her sentence should be rewritten as, a guest asked a friend and me how we met. A simple way to check for the correct pronoun in a case like this is mentally to eliminate the second person. Try saying in your head, a guest asked me how we met. That simple check makes choosing the correct pronoun easier. Take it from me. I'm Jill Robbins.
Thank you.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. Theodore Roosevelt became President of the United States at the beginning of the 20th century. It was a time of great technological progress in the United States. Yet many people felt that there was too little social progress. They demanded reforms in politics, industry, and the use of natural resources. Theodore Roosevelt supported this call for reforms. His first target was big business. This week in our series, Kay Gallant and Harry Monroe continue the story of the presidency of Teddy Roosevelt.
In the early 1900s, a group of wealthy American businessmen agreed to join their railroads. They formed a company or trust to control the joint railroad. The new company would have complete control of rail transportation in the American West. There would be no competition. President Roosevelt believed the new company violated the Sherman antitrust law. The law said it was illegal for businesses to interfere with trade among the states. Roosevelt said he would make no compromises in enforcing the law. He asked the Supreme Court to break up the railroad trust. "We are not," Roosevelt said, "attacking these big companies. We are only trying to do away with any evil in them. We are not hostile to them, but we believe they must be controlled to serve the public good."
The Supreme Court ruled against the railroad trust. In the next few years, other trusts would be broken up in the same way. The American people called this trust busting, and they called Theodore Roosevelt the trust buster. Roosevelt made several speeches explaining his position on big business. Everywhere he went, he found wide public support. Later, he told a friend why people liked him so well. He said, "I put into words what is in their hearts and minds, but not in their mouths."
President Roosevelt won even more public support for his actions during a labor crisis in the coal industry. The incident was one of many in American history in which a president had to decide if he should interfere in private industry. Coal miners went on strike in the spring of 1902. They demanded more pay and safer working conditions. Mine owners refused to negotiate. One even insulted the miners. He said, "The rights and interests of the laboring man will be protected and cared for. It will not be the labor activists who take care of him. It will be the Christian men to whom God, in his great wisdom, has given the control of the property interests of this country." This self-serving use of religion made many Americans support the striking workers.
After several months, President Roosevelt invited coal mine owners and union leaders to a meeting in Washington. He asked them to keep in mind that a third group was involved in their dispute, the public. He warned that the nation faced the possibility of a winter without heating fuel. Roosevelt said, I did not call this meeting to discuss your claims and positions. I called it to appeal to your love of country. The union leaders said they were willing to have the president appoint an independent committee to settle the strike. They said they would accept the committee's decision as final. The mine owners rejected the idea. One warned the president not even to talk about it. Such talk, he said, was illegal interference in private industry.
That made Theodore Roosevelt angry. Later, he said, if it were not for the high office I held, I would have taken him by the seat of the pants and the nape of the neck and thrown him out the window. Finally, Roosevelt got both sides to agree to a compromise. Mine owners agreed to have an independent committee study the miners' demands, and the miners agreed to return to work until the study was completed. Several months later, the report was ready. The committee proposed that miners accept a smaller pay increase in exchange for improved working conditions. Both sides accepted the proposal. The coal strike ended.
Not everyone was happy. Many people still felt Roosevelt had no right to interfere. Roosevelt disagreed. My business, he said, is to see fair play among all men, capitalists or wage workers. All I want to do is see that every man has a fair deal, no more, no less. Roosevelt believed the United States needed a strong leader. He planned to strengthen the presidency whenever he could. Roosevelt was an active, noisy man. As one writer described him, Theodore is always the center of action. When he goes to a wedding, he wants to be the bride. When he goes to a funeral, he wants to be the dead man. Many of Roosevelt's friends thought he was an overgrown boy. You must always remember, one said, that the president is about 6 years old. Another friend sent this message to Roosevelt on his 46th birthday. You have made a very good start in life. We have great hopes for you when you grow up.
Theodore Roosevelt loved outdoor activities. He especially loved the natural beauty of the land. He worried about its future. Roosevelt wrote, I recognize the right and duty of this generation to develop and use the natural riches of our land. But I do not recognize the right to waste them, nor to rob, by wasteful use, the generations that come after us. Roosevelt set aside large areas of forest land for national use. He created 50 special areas to protect wildlife, and he established a number of national parks.
Theodore Roosevelt faced the responsibilities of foreign policy with the same strength he used in facing national problems. He firmly believed in expanding American power in the world. We have no choice, he said, as to whether or not we will play a great part in the world. All that we can decide is whether we will play our part well or poorly. To play well, Roosevelt said, the United States needed a strong navy. It also needed a canal across Central America so the Navy could sail quickly between the Atlantic and Pacific Oceans.
For many years, people had dreamed of such a waterway. With a canal across Central America, ships could sail directly from ocean to ocean. They would not have to make the long, costly voyage around the southern end of South America. The most likely place to build such a canal was at the thinnest point of land, Panama. Another possible place was just to the north, Nicaragua. Over the years, several attempts were made to build the canal.
In the 1880s, Ferdinand de Lesseps, builder of the Suez Canal, formed a French company to build a waterway across Panama. De Lesseps spent $300 million to build just one-third of the canal. He could get no more money. His company failed. In the 1890s, an American company tried to build a canal across Nicaragua. It made little progress. After 3 years, it gave up the attempt. When Theodore Roosevelt became president in the early 1900s, he was ready to try again.
A study was made to decide which would be a better place for the canal, Panama or Nicaragua. Engineers said it would cost less to complete the canal de Lesseps had started 20 years earlier in Panama. But de Lesseps' company still owned the land on which the canal would be built. The United States would have to buy the land as well as the rights to build the waterway. The study decided it would be less costly overall to build the canal in Nicaragua. The proposal went to the United States Congress for approval. That will be our story next week.
Our program was written by Frank Beardsley. The narrators were Kay Gallant and Harry Monroe. You can find our series online with transcripts, MP3s, podcasts, and images at voaspecialenglish.com. You can also follow us on Facebook and Twitter at VOA Learning English. Join us again next week for The Making of a Nation, an American history series in VOA Special English.